It's Danielle Redeutschen, and this is In Talks With, a series of bite-sized chats about culture from lockdown and beyond. Hi, Marisa.
Hi.
Hello. We're speaking to each other on the 11th of August, 2020. I'm in London and you're in Hong Kong. I've just been explaining to you before I started recording that we're experiencing an intense heat wave here in London. And you said that you're just experiencing a third wave of the coronavirus?
Yeah, that's correct.
Second, so, third.
No, it's third.
And for your business and the economy, it's a disaster, right?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a lot of scenario planning, but as you know, I'm a perpetual optimist, so I hope for positive energy, and hopefully things will be looking more positive in the next week or so. I believe it's being controlled quite well now, so we just all have to do our parts.
So just to explain to our listeners, you were part of a team which established Design Trust in Hong Kong in 2014, which is a non-profit grant funding platform which aims to foster design talent and help get projects off the ground in Hong Kong.
I've been, you know, humbly very proud to be part of this community, co-found this Design Trust initiative in 2014, but actually it's been a longer ambition under the Ambassador Design nonprofit organization since 2007. And it came about in one sense to look at and unpack design from our city and our region, but also provide opportunities, grants, and fostering creative ideas that maybe often people might not want to fund. So when you ask me what's my favorite projects, there are countless ones, endless ones, but I believe there are a few highlights maybe I could share that have also been quite a moment of reflection about how important our own heritage is. There was these really wonderful grantees, Polly, Ho, and Andy had developed a series of research films in Guangzhou looking at Canton silk as a, you know, 400-year-old material and fabric dyeing that was hugely popular before. But there's a lot of dyeing techniques that have been lost, so they've been documenting that tradition, exploration, looking at the farmlands and the new narratives it could provide. So those are smaller grants.
How does it work? Do they come to you? So for referring to those artists specifically, do they come to you and ask for your help financially, or is it and what was it specifically about that project that you thought was so compelling and something that you really wanted to support?
So we offer quarterly grants to young designers, researchers, kind of cultural instigators, collectives to come and apply every quarter. So it happens every 3 months. We provide, we call it accelerated granting projects, and designers come and go through quite a rigorous process of application. And we have jury members who vet, debate on its value and selection process. And often it becomes quite competitive because you obviously each quarter there's going to be 20 to 30 submissions. And we have a commitment for design research and excellence for the community. So hence, you know, we can't fund every single project, but definitely ones that focus on the urgency of archiving to sustainability missions. And those are just C grants. We offer also feature grants, which is quite special because it allows our city and our region to also partner with global institutions. And Rem Koolhaas currently has this exciting research on the future of the countryside at the Guggenheim Museum. So our feature grant program supported their funding for a component of the research with institutes. We also have Chow Fei, who's doing this unbelievable quasi-retrospective project showcasing in London. I mean, of course, unfortunately, it's now recently reopened, but a lot of her work is multimedia.
Where in London? Commenting.
at the Serpentine Gallery. Yeah.
Oh yes, so, I saw that one.
Yes, yeah. So those are the projects we focus on to support not only international exchanges between institutions, but it's also this kind of positioning of how to excel and build new knowledge and unique positions of what design can do for the community or the cultural community.
Such an impressive thing you're doing there. What would you say makes Chinese design, or maybe it's more specifically Hong Kong design, so what gives it its unique characteristics?
Oh goodness, this is a challenging question you put forward. I think I will share it through one of the programs we recently conducted last year at this extraordinary 1940s heritage building. And it was related to the Tiger Balm family who had built this incredible, beautiful private mansion. And along the side of it, it was this incredible public space, a garden of both in mythology, but a way to also
Sorry,
advertise.
Can I just stop you? I sound a bit ignorant here, but is it Tiger Balm family? Is that the family that produce, manufacture Tiger Balm, the product?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, the ointment, yeah, right, for health and wellness. Right, it's super famous. But they are no longer, the family no longer owns it. It's actually now run by a Singapore organization. But what's extremely fascinating, obviously, with that process is unpacking what is Chinese, what is Hong Kong, what is identity, and by matching these brilliant design mentors with young designers from our program, we could, through making and crafting, begin to uncover and unpack these questions you've just asked. What is Hong Kong? What is Chinese design? So there's obviously like this amazing young designer that we've been supporting for quite a long time, who's a graphic artist. He's been investigating a very specific typography that is a Hong Kong font, now it's claimed. Of course, it's been through, you know, different histories, and his effort is to save it by contemporizing the font through different techniques of making and crafting. And this is quite unique. It only is present in our signboards in Hong Kong and Southern China and Chinatowns in London, which is uniquely a Hong Kong sort of Pearl River Delta Southern region font style. And so we're unpacking these things that have, of course, certain cultural influences, and going back to the Ho Pa mansion, Ho Pa villa. Yeah, no, so this mansion became this backdrop to analyze Hong Kong's rich heritage and legacy of individuals and collective communities that have been shaping narratives of design. And through this, you know, we were able to work with like curators from the V&A as a mentor, mentoring young designers who've been looking at narratives of graphics and design to produce new work. And through this, the narrative is, yes, this is an incredible Fujianese original family from Southern China making and producing the most powerful medicinal herb, like Tiger Balm ointment, moving to Hong Kong and Singapore and producing this kind of multicultural context that allowed us to understand much deeper meanings of what is Hong Kong design through these different cultural contexts. And I think that's where the power of our unique kind of presence allows us to really unfold these new narratives and our rich history. I mean, of course, there's many, many mediums to communicate the uniqueness. But of course, as you know, a trained architect myself, and having taught in universities and now running this foundation, primarily, and of course, the power of our own urban city and urban landscape has its own cues to the kind of contemporary and the heritage aspects. Yeah.
What's the name of the artist you were just mentioning earlier? The calligraphy artist. What's their name?
Yes, his name is Ndonyan Chan, and he is, I would say now, you know, a very successful graphic branding, has started his own agency. But he basically, out of his thesis, realized there wasn't a modern typeface that could be representative of our culture. And so his dream was to contemporize, archive it, and thus won the seed grant. And obviously now has been producing a lot of new types of book design, graphic design, website. His project's called Trilingual, so looking at English and Chinese and contemporary Chinese culture and combining that and making a much more robust presence. So it's a brilliant thing. And we've taken him on our journey. So we've taken him as also originally as a grantee's publisher's book. And then we've now taken on board a couple years ago, partnering with some top, you know, interior designers to produce events with like Andre Fu, who's the, you know, one of the top Hong Kong interior designers who designed the Upper House and a lot of hotels around the world. So we have this really interesting, opportunity as a neutral nonprofit organization to foster cultural experimentations and heritage and discover new narratives, which I think is incredibly important in the context of today, especially today.
Right. Well, you seem so passionate about it and about your role. Give me an idea of how did you arrive at doing what you do now?
My journey.
Your journey.
Oh God.
a potted version.
Oh gosh, you know, I tend to talk a little bit too much. I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, I was very lucky to have my own graduate and studies and school programs and won a scholarship to have the opportunity to study in the US.
You grew up in Hong Kong?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm from here. And of course, you know, the kind of cultural family networks, it's very dynamic. We have, you know, family, you know, that had to grow up in Macau or Guangzhou and Hong Kong and immigration. And of course, the lucky opportunities to go beyond our own city at those kind of trying times back in the 70s and 80s. So I've always been really intrigued by growing up here, you know, during the colonial period, having those wonderful opportunities to also study in these incredible contexts. But every time observing the city transformation, and especially when I did have those wonderful opportunities to study abroad, my graduate program, I did this thesis on kind of local and globalization context of the city and factory productions, and had really obsessed looking at the growth of the Pearl River Delta, where we had family friends who own factories in China, and watching that urbanization of, you know, these villages pretty much turning into manufacturing hubs. And I think that's always framed the backdrop of the interest in urbanization and city development and research culture. And with these opportunities, of course, you know, I've worked in the corporate field in New York in some amazing companies, but at the same time, experimenting with my partner and started up our own design art studio back in 2003 in New York, and then had great opportunity to teach in London at the AA, Architecture Association, and then got offered jobs in Hong Kong to come back in 2007 and 8. So that's sort of my trajectory of both, you know, working in kind of corporate architectural offices to working down on a lot of volunteering grassroots community projects and curating shows on shoestring budgets, and realizing you know, how can we work as an academic, cultural community and empower our community to build a much more vibrant cultural exchange? And so that started my journey on being invited to join the board. Actually, I was a board member for 13 years of this charity. And in, you know, this was already back in 2008, doing a lot of huge design festivals free to the public, also behind the scenes revitalizing public assets like heritage buildings, which could offer so much more for the community, working with the government to local grassroots communities to open up these spaces. And now, back in when I think about it, I think the real transition point was 2009. We got a really great opportunity to be a curatorial team in my position back then as the chief curator for the 2009 Hong Kong Shenzhen Bi-City Biennial on the West Kowloon site, and in partnership with this incredible group of curators in Shenzhen. And that pretty much expanded my passion, as you say, or interest through how architecture or design could offer new ways of thinking about how we can impact our city. And so hence, this is where I am today, fast forward 2020, facilitating, mobilizing, showcasing, and nurturing all sorts of conversations. And hopefully, in one sense, seeing design as a diplomacy, or design as a way to exchange ideas, and how we can be much more open-minded on different cultures and experiences for younger communities to participate in. Yeah. So I sort of, long-winded way of.
No, it's all very, very, it's really interesting. And I love that you bring such a personal story to it. Having the perspective you have on your country, how do you feel about how the landscape has changed really intensively, especially over the last few years with the protests and then most recently COVID?
It's a really tough, challenging time. Even pre-COVID, of course, we had to build resilience still within, individuals or family networks or even academia. And, obviously on a personal note, my other half, runs and heads up, Department of Architecture at one of the universities. And it's been, I would say one of the most challenging times I think we all have faced, even pre-COVID outburst, based on the will of the community to have to state positions. At the same time, there's a lot of policies and uncertainties about the future of our city. Of course, we're part of China. We're a special administrative region of China. But we have a huge commitment of, all sorts of businesses to retail, to welfare issues to handle. And it's been really a moment where you realize, also what can a foundation like us do? And hence, actually, even back in 2014, when we started the foundation, it was also a reaction to the 2014 moments of watching young students claim, participation in the city. And it was unbelievable, right? So from our end, we always see our foundation, extraordinarily lucky with, and there's always this photo I think I've showed you one time where we're all sitting around, there's about 50 of us in a round table. It's one of those powerful images where we had a real open discussion on this theme, small is meaningful, unpacking why is it so expensive to live in Hong Kong, and how come micro living and real estate trajectories are looking at like this today. And of course, it goes back to a lot of land utilization policies. Of course, we're a city that surprisingly, I always look at positive sides, 75% of our city is actually countryside and not built area. So you have this incredible compactness of people living in extreme quarters, but then people still building higher and tighter. And that lends itself to, investments and real estate pricing that pushes out a lot of people can't afford to live in the city. So there's a lot of issues relating to land utilization, policies, and hence that's why, you know, when we did start the foundation, we did build this special mentor-mentee think tank community platform called the Design Trust Future Studios to impact these questions and say, well, what can we do? Could we actually impact policy? And hence now, fast forward, we've been doing these series of research analysis, working with businesses, government, local grassroots communities to build and improve public spaces. Because if the trajectory of living is really micro living, I mean, now it's actually a joke. People saying, yes, it's nano flats, 125 square meet, you know, like feet apartments. Is that human, you know, conditioning? Is that proper, right? So if there's a tuning of understanding the real estate, the context, how we can design ergonomically and comfortably for families, while with the mindset of improving public space, that's where we're positioning the foundation's work, is how can we improve all these incredible public micro parks projects around the city. And this is something where we still want to push optimism and positivity and set up these new models of designing. So we have a very neutral platform looking at existing structures and at the same time involving our younger design community as mentees to have a voice and can actually join the drawing boards. And now we have two parks underway being built. We have two coming on board. And end of last year, the government policy announced 170 small public play spaces will be revitalized in the next 5 years. So we're hoping we're just doing a small part of being part of a bigger picture, but just doing little things and micro interventions to add some hope and positive stakeholder engagement projects, yeah. But it has been a real challenge, yes, absolutely, to unpack and understand where we're heading right now.
You were going to tell me a little bit about something you're working on for the future.
Yeah, so our foundation, you know, we did a big survey a couple months ago, and having a rethink, a remapping, since unfortunately all our festivals have been shut down to, you know, we had actually some amazing designers producing work in Milan for the Milan Fair, or grantees presenting work at the China Pavilion or Hong Kong Pavilion. So we've been kind of remapping and looking back at our community and seeing what we could do. We did a really powerful internal check-in. So I'm pleased to say we're going to be launching very soon, in a month or so, a project called the Design Trust Critically Homemade. And, you know, there's obviously, we know, a drive in all of us to help each other and restore social connection. Of course, through these kind of devastating times, some studios have, you know, obviously lost jobs and being challenged. So we're producing this critically homemade project to challenge designers to produce these small prototypes that fit in a palm, and in a way to create something new that can go beyond on support well-being. It's quite organic, but now we have 68 designers on board crafting and making these objects and prototypes. And they're as incredible as, you know, again, Adonian, making these Beiwei typography homemade cookies to COVID-19 antibacterial door handles by a very famous Hong Kong-based but British designer. We also have these amazing architects and designers crafting these scholarly rock Lego chess building sets to also inspire young designers and families on Chinese history and gardens, but make it playful. And the proceeds will plow back into the foundation, quasi-fundraising for the designers, but also building our future legacy. So I'm really excited. I hope to be able to share more with you in the future on this project. And we're now building a website platform for that, encouraging our community to pledge support and encourage all the great work that these incredible researchers and designers are producing to keep the momentum going.
Fantastic. And just quickly before you go, I wanted to ask you as well, do you think, just going back to the protests, what kind of a direct impact has it had on design?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's actually unbelievable. The design community that has participated, just from observing and the awareness, has been extraordinary, right? And actually earlier on, internally, we're thinking about, okay, what you know, this is a very, actually very special moment. Has there been documentarists? Have there been people documenting the graphics coming out of this? And we do have one grantee who's producing a project called After, and it's connecting to another media platform where they also are building very famous photographers, matching them with writers and designers to observe the city, to collect rapidly what's been coming through from a design standpoint, which I'm quite excited to look forward to that. And I think they're going to be doing a show in January. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, of course, you know, the unrest is making us really think about what is this Cantonese culture. It's, you know, obviously the language part is Southern. And of course, a lot of the language aspects are very different to other parts of, whether it's simplified Chinese or even Taiwanese spoken language, and Guangdonghua or Guangdonghua, which is a very different tonation, is making us think a bit deep about how could you actually do more with that as a moment through the design expression or projects or product making. But in terms of value organization, it's been, you know, I think a very challenging time to understand what is even being taught in schools and universities and curriculums, and how one would observe that, because it's such a tough time during these times. And I do get a sense, as an observer, a lot more self-censoring happening, which is perhaps unfortunate, but maybe that's going to trickle up later onto even more creativity and even more reason why, you know, our museums or a lot of the research that is happening in or outside of the foundation or connections and collaborations with other institutions are even more important to connect on these topics. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Marisa, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for your invitation.
Great. I hope your lockdown ends soon.
Me too. And I hope to meet you physically and in real one day too, in London, if I can travel, or maybe you in Hong Kong.
You've been listening to In Talks with me, Danielle Radoichin. The sound and theme music were by Wargi Productions, and the artwork is by Patrick Waugh. If you enjoyed this episode, please pass it on to someone who you think might also like it. And of course, please do subscribe and leave a review. Thanks for listening.